to Virtual You, the radio program of self-exploration, where the focus is on our capacity to live consciously and fully, integrating the wisdom of spirit with practical affairs of science, business, and culture. Virtual You, presented by Wisdom Radio. And now your host, Jeffrey Mishlock.
Hello, Wisdom Land. Today we are going to focus on exercises from the world's religions to cultivate kindness, love, joy, peace, vision, wisdom, and generosity. My guest is Dr. Roger Walsh, a member of the faculty of the Department of Psychiatry, the University of California at Irvine. With his wife, Frances Fawn, he is co-author of Paths Beyond Ego and Gifts from A Course in Miracles. He is also author of Essential Spirituality, the Seven Central Practices to Awaken Heart and Mind. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
It's a pleasure to be with you. It seems as if the basic premise of your book, Essential Spirituality, is that in the world's religions, there is a core tradition. And what that core tradition seems to be about ultimately is a sense of cultivating a more evolved human being.
Yes, I think that's true. In fact, I think this is one of the hallmarks of our time, and this is the first time in human history we've had all of the world's great religious traditions available to us, and being able to discern the underlying core of common wisdom and practices that lie at the contemplative heart of all of them. And in some way, I think there are really two common elements. There's a common core, the so-called perennial wisdom, a common core of wisdom and understanding about the nature of reality, and there's also a common core of practices. Practices designed to what are variously being called awaken us or enlighten us or liberate us or bring us to salvation. Practices which train and transform and transcend the mind so as to awaken us to our true nature and true potential.
Mm-hmm. There are some people who would say that the purpose of religion is to obey the laws of God, and that all of these so-called spiritual practices are sort of secondary forms of mental and spiritual hygiene.
Well, in one sense, one can see the idea that people are getting at here. They're talking really about ethics, and one understanding of ethics is that you simply obey the divine law. Of course, there's a lot of difference and argument about what exactly the divine laws are, or how we interpret them. But at the contemplative heart of each of the great traditions, there's a somewhat more psychologically sophisticated understanding of what ethics is about. And it's not so much do this or God will get you. Rather, the deeper understanding of ethics stems from a recognition that when we deliberately hurt or harm other people, we suffer ourselves. And we act, when we're unethical, out of destructive mental states and emotions such as greed and hate and jealousy and anger. And what's more, we reinforce those qualities. We drive them deeper into our psyches. On the other hand, when we're ethical, when we try to live with love and compassion and gentleness, then we cultivate those qualities and we reduce the qualities of such as greed and fear and jealousy and anger. So from that understanding, which is more the understanding at the contemplative heart of the great religious traditions, it's a more psychologically sophisticated view. It's a view which understands the nature of our minds, which understands that our minds need to be healed and trained and transformed. And from that perspective, then one not only does live more ethically and kindly, but one wants to, because you see it's helpful to yourself as well as to others.
Mm-hmm. So rather than think of spiritual practice as a form of hygiene, like brushing your teeth, it becomes more of a whole way of life, something that's central to the core of your being.
Yes, very much so. And clearly one of the tenets or central goals of spiritual practice is to move spirituality and the religious life from just something one does on Sundays or Sabbath or something one does, you know, for a few minutes before a meal, into a way of life, a way of life which encompasses all one's activities, waking, moving, relating. working, and which brings an intimate relationship to the spiritual and a loving relationship to other people into all activities.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great way to live, I think, if you can feel a sense of loving communion with all other people and feel a sense of that same love for yourself. I mean, that's really being in touch with the life force.
Well, very much so, yes. And love is at the heart of each of the great traditions. One of the seven practices that are common to world religions, and which I outline essential spirituality, is the transformation of emotions. And what each of the great religious traditions, whether it's the Western monotheisms of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, or the Asian traditions such as Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, Confucianism, At the heart, one finds each of them saying that we really need to transform our emotions, that our emotional life is central to a spiritual life. Mm-hmm. And so they point out that there are really two things we need to be aware of. We need to be aware that some emotions are very dangerous and destructive, anger, jealousy, fear, for example. And on the other hand, some emotions such as love and joy and compassion are not only feel good, but they're actually conducive to living a full spiritual contributory life, and that they are both a means to our awakening and spiritual growth and also an expression of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, to me, one of the core practices would be stillness, learning how to be silent within.
Well, very much so, yes. It's also quite a challenge, as we all know, particularly in our frenetic, soundbite-driven culture these days. But yes, very much so. When we turn our attention inward in meditation or contemplation, we find that our minds are just a jumble of activity, a whirlwind of ceaseless motion, that we're just not used to being quiet, and that the frenetic activity around us reflects the frenetic activity within us. And so one of the great challenges that all of us face when we want to live more spiritually with greater awareness and sensitivity is that we do need to learn how to be quiet, how to still ourselves. And at first, that quietness may be more external. We may want to live a lifestyle of voluntary simplicity, for example, in which we let go some of the external clutter and activities to focus on what's more central and essential to our lives. And then gradually that external quieting is brought within, and we learn to calm and quiet and collect the mind until we do begin to experience first very briefly, but hopefully eventually more continuously, an inner silence, an inner quiet. And it's interesting that this inner quiet has been described as one of the great goals and means for a spiritual life. And there have been some beautiful quotes. For example, Father Thomas Keating said that silence is the language God speaks, and everything else is a bad translation.
That's beautiful. It reminds me of the notion from the Kabbalah that the original sound of the creation of the universe was the letter Aleph in the Hebrew language, which is the silent letter.
Ah, yes, I didn't know that.
Yeah. That's the mystical significance of the Aleph. And or I suppose that silence, again, it's reflected in the Zen koan. What is the sound of one hand clapping?
Yes, silence is a recurrent theme in many traditions. Black Elk, the Native American wise man, said that is not silence the voice of the Great Spirit itself? One finds repetitively the idea that silence, in silence we can hear what cannot be said, the wisdom which lies beyond words.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose for me, the need for silence is, well, the way I view it is as if the self is like an onion with layers and layers, and the outer layers are the noisier ones. And when we can learn to quiet them down, then we can listen to the deeper layers.
Yeah, I think that's a nice metaphor or example. And yes, indeed, what we do find as we go deeper and deeper within is a profundity that we really hadn't suspected was there. And eventually we come to the recognition that who and what we are is not only more than we think, it's more than we can think.
We'll be back with Roger Walsh after these messages.
the experience of falling in love didn't have to end? What if love never died? And what if it could happen to you? Kenny and Julia Loggins share their passionate journey with us and in the process illuminate the path for others. Their book, The Unimaginable Life, is about power and paradox, sacred selfishness and vulnerability, creativity, and a brand new kind of courage. It demonstrates the healing nature of conscious love through the eyes of two people who have traveled far to arrive at that state. Kenny and Julia offer their shared experience through intense personal journals and love letters, lyrics, and poetry. Their story is at once intimate and universal. Purchase your copy of The Unimaginable Life for $12 by calling 1-888-947-3669. That's 1-888-WISDOM-9.
Hi, I'm Joanne Woodward. Ever notice how many things in life happen in a circle? The seasons, revolving credit, hula hoops, the spinning of the circle we call Earth, and recycling. Together, we've already made a difference. Sorting glass, plastic, separating cans, stacking newspapers. Now there are lots of products made from things we've already recycled. A paperclip, in a more daring life, a 56 convertible. A cereal box, once your Sunday paper. It all goes back to the circle. It starts when we recycle trash at home and at work. It's completed when we buy products made from recycled materials. How do you know the difference? Check the label for something called post-consumer recycled content. Then buy the highest percentage of it you can find. You'll save a tree, you'll save energy, and in your own way, you'll help save the world. Complete the circle.
For your free buy recycled shopping guide, call 1-800-CALL-EDF, brought to you by the Ad Council and EDF, the Environmental Defense Fund.
Prayer is a powerful force, a force you will see and feel while reading Rosemary Ellen Guiley's book, Prayer Works. Her book recounts more than 150 true and incredible stories of how people were touched through answered prayers. This deeply moving collection of letters from across the country was taken from the files of Silent Unity, one of the nation's oldest and most popular telephone prayer ministries. From overcoming financial difficulties to dramatic changes in health-related challenges, Rosemary shares how this simple act of praying transforms lives and situations. To purchase your copy of Prayer Works for $12.95, call 1-888-947-3669, 1-888-WISDOM-9.
Welcome back to Virtual You. I'm your host, Jeffrey Mishlove. My guest is Dr. Roger Walsh, author of Essential Spirituality. We're talking about the seven central practices to awaken heart and mind. We began our segment by talking about the need for silence, for inner awareness through contemplation. And some techniques for this are very extensive. They've been developed over thousands of years. For example, Buddhist meditation practice, which I know has been part of your own interest. Other traditions are, I think, less evolved when it comes, say, to meditation. You hear, especially these days, because it's becoming popular in Christian and Jewish traditions, some emphasis on meditation, but it doesn't seem to have the same depth of background as one would find in the East.
Yes, it's an interesting observation. Actually, there is a myth in our culture that meditation is something that belongs only to the East, that one finds, for example, only in Hinduism and yoga and Buddhism. But in point of fact, meditation has an honored place in each of the great religious traditions, though its role has been different in East and West. In the East, meditation has been something that almost, you know, many, many people do, whether they're monks and nuns or lay people. But an average lay person who's a religious-minded person would consider meditation an important part of their life. In the West, however, the meditative traditions mainly fell into the background and were reserved more for contemplatives and were to a significant extent lost. For example, in Judaism, the Kabbalistic tradition was hidden for various reasons and reserved for people who were regarded as exceptionally mature and able to undertake these practices. But as you mentioned, in our own time, these meditative practices in the Western traditions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, are being brought to the fore. There's an increasing search within these traditions for the meditative practices which are their own, and a recognition that these are very valuable. And so I think one of the intriguing things that's happening as a result of the mixing of East and West is that not only have we had an influx of Eastern traditions and practices, the meditation yoga of Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism, for example, but this has led to a revival of these practices in the West, and that the Western traditions have gone back into their own history, revived practices which had largely been lost, and found that they are quite wonderful and powerful and effective. One thinks, for example, of Father Thomas Keating's centering prayer, based on very old practices such as one finds in the Cloud of Unknowing. And large numbers of people are now finding this very simple practice in which one simply repeats a key word, a meaningful word to oneself very gently and quietly, can be very powerful. So these very simple, ancient, and effective techniques can really are really coming into their own again after centuries of neglect in the West.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's important in that any meditative practice is going to be of some benefit, but it strikes me that a practice that has been carefully honed and cultivated over thousands of years continuously and is also integrated into a philosophical understanding that includes the nature of mind, the nature of spirit, its relationship to matter, as you would find in the Vedanta tradition, for example, or in the Prajnaparamita tradition of Buddhism, that there is just incomparable sophistication there.
Yes, there's certainly a wealth of sophisticated techniques and philosophical and psychological understanding in some of those Asian traditions. And one of the things that's happening now is that we in the West are beginning to tap into them. There has, of course, been an influx of these practices into the West. And at first it was kind of an esoteric thing. You know, people on the fringes of our culture, if you perhaps, took these up first. But now they're becoming quite mainstream. And there are some 6 million people in the United States alone who have practiced meditation at some stage or other, and the numbers keep growing. In addition, there's been an interesting marriage of contemplative wisdom and practices from the East and contemporary scholarship and research in the West, whereby for the first time yogic practitioners, Buddhist meditators, Taoist yogis, etc., are being brought into the Western scientific laboratories and studied. And what we're finding is that, just as was claimed, these practices do seem to be quite powerful and effective and seem to be capable of inducing a variety of changes in both mind and body. One can find, for example, a wide array of psychological benefits that accrue, physiological changes. And it's interesting now that meditation is recommended as a medical treatment for disorders such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, stress, anxiety, chronic anxiety, stress disorders of one kind or another, and also for drug addiction. So we're finding that these spiritual practices, although they were originally designed purely for spiritual benefits, have a variety of psychological and somatic benefits as well. So we're really beginning to find that the effects are widespread, spanning the range of mind-body effects, and that they are beneficial not only for people who are already in good health and want merely to learn and to grow, but also are very powerful and effective therapeutic techniques for people with various psychological and psychosomatic disorders.
In a sense, it strikes me that the various methods of meditation could be viewed as technologies, and it's easy to sort of lump them all together and say, yes, they're all meditation, they'll all help you to relax, they will all help you to be a better person, to be more at peace with yourself, but when you get into the nuances, they're very different. It might be like you know, shortwave radio versus the AM/FM bands. When you learn how to work with the finer points of meditation, you can achieve very precise results.
Yes, I think you're right, Jeff. And it's sometimes been said that the East and West specialized in different kinds of technology. We in the West specialized in external technology, learning how to manipulate and change the environment and derive benefits from science and external technology. On the other hand, in the East, they were more specialist in an inner technology, a technology or training of the mind, learning to develop and cultivate our psychological and spiritual capacities with remarkable sophistication. I think you're pointing to something very important here, that when we look at some of these traditions, for example, the yogas of India, or, for example, Tibetan Buddhist practices, we find that there's an awesome sophistication that these people have, as you said, literally spent thousands of years exploring the mind to a remarkable degree and depth, and have plumbed it to depths actually considerably beyond, in some ways, beyond what we've managed to find in Western psychology. And of course, there's now an interesting merger of Eastern and Western psychology, sometimes called transpersonal psychology, where there's this attempt to take the best of both East and West, the laboratory and experimental methods of Western psychology, plus the contemplative training methods of Asian and contemplative traditions, and to meld them into an encompassing psychology for a greater and deeper understanding of the mind than either tradition can provide alone.
Well, I'm a big believer in transpersonal psychology, and I know you're considered one of the leaders in that discipline, because it seems to me that the premise of it is that the spiritual traditions of humanity are now the birthright of all people, and as are the academic traditions, and that these traditions should be undergoing a fusion right now would seem to be almost a historical necessity.
Indeed, we're in a new phase in human history when, for the first time, we have the contemplative traditions of all the world available to us. We have a psychology and science capable of studying the mind in ways and with greater sophistication than was ever possible before. So we can bring to bear on an understanding of the mind, the training and development of the mind, our own growth and potential, a range and richness of approaches that is quite unknown in human history. And so transpersonal psychology was really born out of this desire to integrate ancient wisdom with contemporary knowledge and to bring the best of these into laboratories, to research them as best we could, and to give us the fullest possible picture of the mind and its potentials.
It seems to me that we may very well be on the dawn of a new science, a science that integrates the external empirical approach with the internal introspective approach.
Yes, I think you're right, and hopefully that will happen, and it's really one of the great opportunities and challenges of our time.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking with Dr. Roger Walsh, professor of psychiatry at the University of California at Irvine and author of Essential Spirituality, Exercises from the World's Religions to Cultivate Kindness, Love, Joy, Peace, Vision, Wisdom, and Generosity. We'll return after these messages from Wisdom Radio.
Life is very simple. What we give out, we get back. Those are the opening lines in Louise Hay's book, You Can Heal Your Life. The book helps us restructure our lives and find self-esteem and self-love. Hay teaches us how to let go of old fears and negative thought patterns to create joy in the present moment, to give out love and to get it back. Hay further explores the body-mind-spirit connection in Heal Your Body. The book examines how our attitudes and beliefs manifest on the physical level, and it offers affirmations to help us accept ourselves and become whole. The third book in this collection, Love Your Body, helps us learn to love ourselves literally from head to toe. Three books that will change how you perceive yourself and others. Purchase You Can Heal Your Life, Heal Your Body, and Love Your Body for $22.95 by calling 1-888-947-3669. That's 1-888-WISDOM-9. Why am I here on Earth? What am I supposed to be doing with my life? How can I find my mission and fulfill it? Carol Adrian has spent the last 3 years traveling the country, conducting workshops and seminars, focusing on those very questions. Now she offers her expert guidance to all of us, in The Purpose of Your Life Experiential Guide. This book shows us how to use coincidence, synchronicity, and intuition to find our purpose in life, achieving the rewards that come from living in harmony with our soul's code. The Purpose of Your Life Experiential Guide will help you align with your soul's purpose, discover that anything is possible, learn to follow your intuition, and transform obstacles. The Purpose of Your Life Experiential Guide is available for $22 by calling 1-888-947-3669, 1-888-WISDOM-9.
Do you live each moment to the hilt? What with jobs, families, the stress of daily life, most of us probably don't. In his new book, Stephen Levine teaches us how to live each moment, each hour, each day mindfully, as if it were all that was left. On his deathbed, Socrates told his followers to practice dying as the highest form of wisdom. Levine decided to live this way himself for a year. He shares with us how such immediacy radically changes our view of the world. It's an exercise that gives us the opportunity to deal with unfinished business and enter into a new relationship with life. Levine provides us with a program of intensely practical strategies and powerful guided meditations to help with this work. Purchase A Year to Live for $11 by calling 1-888-947-3669. That's 1-888-WISDOM-9. A new way of thinking. Wisdom Radio.
Cultivate your body, mind, and spirit with herbs. Mother Nature's Herbal teaches us how to grow our own herbs organically, how to make our own herbal remedies, and even create natural skincare products. And it's easy to do. Judy Griffin carefully takes us step by step through the process of weaving herbs into our lives so we can reap the benefits every day. She uses down-to-earth language to expand our understanding of these gifts of the earth. Mother Nature's Herbal is entertaining and educational. A handbook for anyone looking for a way to bring nature into their lives for improved health and happiness. Order your copy for $19.95 by calling toll-free 1-888-947-3669. Again, that's 1-888-WISDOM-9.
Welcome back to Virtual You. I'm your host, Jeffrey Mishlove. My guest today is Professor Roger Walsh, author of Essential Spirituality. We're looking at what the world's spiritual traditions have to say about human evolution. One way to express this is that people are searching for happiness. They want to experience pleasure and avoid pain. And so much of our materialistic pursuits seem to be designed to provide happiness in the form of pleasure. And the irony seems to be that in the most affluent countries of the world, both in Asia and in the West, the people are not necessarily happier for all of the material benefits that we have.
Yes, that's a very interesting observation. In fact, we're really the first civilization in history which has been able to test for ourselves the validity of the ancient religious claims that having a lot of things doesn't necessarily make you happy. Of course, this question of what makes us happy is really one of the fundamental questions at the heart of human existence. And all of us, whether consciously or unconsciously, are living our lives in our own responses to this question. And if we look around our culture to get a sense of what our culture believes will make us happy, the answer is very clear. It's things and lots of them. And every billboard sign and television wails forth a siren song saying, you know, if you just have this, buy this, get this, then you'll be happy. So it's a very interesting question. Do they work? And you pointed to the fact that, well, maybe they don't. And actually, there's been some very interesting research within the last couple of decades in which sociologists and social psychologists have actually measured happiness and traced what happens as income goes up or as cultures change in various ways. And they've actually begun to map out pretty well now what makes for happiness. And the first thing that's obvious is money doesn't. Yeah. Now, we need to qualify this and say that, of course, living in poverty can create dire suffering. And we absolutely need to do everything we possibly can to make sure that everyone in society, in fact, on the planet, has enough to live on, enough to have a decent life, enough to get an education, etc. So not having any money can make for a great deal of suffering. But what's really interesting is that above a certain threshold, once people have enough to live on fairly well, to be clothed and fed and sheltered and educated, turns out that having more money and possessions than that doesn't seem to impact happiness much at all. In fact, between 1970 and 1990, the average buying power of United States citizens doubled. Did that double happiness? Happiness didn't change a whit, didn't go up anything. In fact, some social indicators of happiness went down. So that's one interesting study. There are other interesting individual studies. For example, people who win the lottery are less happy 1 year later than before they won it. They've had their big high, they got the big rush. After that, it's kind of an anticlimax, a letdown. So that's an interesting thing. There are lots of these studies which bear out the general principle that once you have enough to live modestly and well, having more money and possessions doesn't do a great deal. It can make a little bit of difference, but just not much at all. Now, of course, the interesting thing is that that's exactly what the great religious traditions have been telling us for 2,000 years. They, they're not big on poverty, but they are very clear that mammon was used as the old-fashioned word, or greed for acquiring and getting things, is not the way to real happiness, and that from the perspective of religious traditions, this constant obsessive search for things outside ourselves to get more goodies is based on a tragic misunderstanding of who and what we really are and what we really need. And the great tradition suggests that what we really want, what most of all drives us, is to come to know our true identity and to recognize that our true identity is a sacred identity, intimately related to the divine. And that as long as we're divorced from this recognition, as long as we live in a condition of alienation and mistaken identity, we're never going to be really happy. We're always going to be driven by a certain degree of anxiety and angst and discomfort. And so from their perspective, this failure to recognize what we really want, the failure to recognize that we truly are seeking to be who and what we really are, to come to, we're really seeking to know ourselves. When we don't know that, then we engage in this obsessive quest for things outside ourselves, which they would regard as mere substitute gratifications. The problem is that we can never get enough of what we don't really want. And so we can go out there and spend a lifetime racing around, acquiring things, getting one goodie after another. But since it's not what we really want, then it's never going to fully and completely satisfy. And that's one of the central messages of the great traditions, that no thing will ever fully or permanently satisfy us. But they do claim that there is a discovery which can truly satisfy, and that is the discovery of our true nature. And that is, of course, described as salvation or enlightenment or satori or any number of words. But all of them are words pointing to the idea that if we uncover our true nature, if we come to know ourselves truly, then we discover that that true nature is sacred and blissful and peaceful. And that knowledge, that awareness, provides an ecstasy far beyond what any goodie from the world can give us.
Mm-hmm. So the key to uncovering the true nature is, I suppose, to transfer some of our attachments from the things of the external world towards the quest for self-understanding.
Yes, indeed. It's a transformation of emotion or of motivation, or a redirection of motivation. In our culture, in so many cultures, much of our motivation is externally directed because we don't know that there is this greater self within us to be discovered. So we seek outside ourselves in a hopeless quest. And we get attached to the things of the world. If we believe that having more goodies will make us happy, then of course we get attached and addicted to them. So the great traditions recommend a couple of things. They recommend first that we let go our attachment to the things of the world, are craving after them. They don't say the things of the world are bad. They don't say that money and power and sex are bad, although that's a common misunderstanding. What they do say is that our attachment or craving for them creates suffering. So the first thing they recommend is letting go some of our attachment to these external things. And as you suggested, redirecting that energy or motivation towards a self-discovery, a training and cultivating of our minds and being, and more towards an inner search or discovery, which they claim will ultimately give far greater satisfaction. Mm-hmm.
Yet there seems to be another little pitfall in there. It's sometimes been referred to as spiritual materialism, where people approach the spiritual quest with that same sense of wanting to own, wanting to possess, as they have in their material desire to accumulate. So people want to accumulate spiritual treasures.
Yes, yes, and the term spiritual materialism, as you used it, is a very good one. And I think that's just a natural and normal and almost inescapable complication as we begin a spiritual path. You know, when we start on a spiritual path, we're not pure and free of these destructive motives. So we do tend to do that, and we have to be gentle and kind with ourselves and realize that we're going to make mistakes as we go along a spiritual path. And sure enough, we do. And we've all done them, and we'll make more. And the challenge is to do two things at once. One is to recognize and work to let go these foolish mistakes. And the other is not to judge ourselves too harshly for them. There's a kind of wise combination of discernment and forgiveness that's really important.
Mm-hmm. And it seems as if at some level a spiritual path is more about letting go than it is about accumulating or gaining or evolving or becoming more than one is.
Yes, there's a saying in Taoism that the person of knowledge acquires something new every day, and the person of wisdom lets go something every day. Uh-huh. So yes, indeed. And the letting go, which is a synonym for releasing attachments, is really a crucial element of any spiritual path, and certainly has been advocated by wise people in each of the great religions.
Mm-hmm. And what you're really talking about here in particular are letting go of the darker, heavier emotions of greed, anger, envy.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking with Professor Roger Walsh, author of Essential Spirituality, a wonderful book with a foreword, incidentally, by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. We'll return to our discussion after these messages.
The name Florence Nightingale conjures up a romantic image of the lady with the lamp who founded modern nursing. However, this image trivializes the accomplishments and character of one of the most remarkable women of the 19th century. In the book Florence Nightingale, Mystic, Visionary, Healer, author Barbara Montgomery Dossey reveals the many facets of this complex, brilliant woman, including her little-known but fascinating mystical side. This dazzling new biography, thoroughly researched and lavishly illustrated with over 280 photos and sketches, is a testament to a woman who not only changed the world in her lifetime, but also continues to speak to us today. Call 1-888-947-3669 to order Florence Nightingale, Mystic Visionary Healer, for $49.95. 1-888-WISDOM-9.
John Gray has devoted himself to helping men and women relate better to one another. He's offered advice for married couples and for those in the midst of their dating years. Now he turns his expert attention to those who are starting over after a divorce, breakup, or the loss of a loved one. His new book, Mars and Venus, Starting Over, is a practical guide for finding love again. Drawing on insights derived from 28 years of counseling thousands of men and women, John Gray helps us through the most challenging experience of a lifetime. His book examines the healing process for both men and women, shows us how to move through the pain, heal it, and open our hearts again. He also shares with us how men and women typically start over and how we can make this a positive process. Mars and Venus Starting Over will inspire you to rise to the challenge of healing your heart and to move on to find even greater love. Order your copy of Mars and Venus Starting Over for $25 by calling 1-888-947-3669. That's 1-888-WISDOM-9. According to the American Anthropological Association, the concept of race has no validity in the human species. While most of us might agree that on a biological, scientific level, races do not exist, exploring ideas and feelings about race and racism can be difficult. Unique in its spiritual approach, the book Beyond Fear presents a refreshing vision of the internal peace possible for each individual as we release our social and cultural beliefs about race. Using personal stories, Aisha and Kokomon Clote give us tools to help us clarify our intent as we progress through the 12 spiritual keys to racial healing. Purchase your copy of Beyond Fear for $12.95 by calling 1-888-947-3669. That's 1-888-WISDOM-9.
How can I live a more meaningful life? It's a simple question, but many times we feel we don't have the answer. We believe that our problems and goals are so complex that no one can even begin to understand. But the answer to this simple question and many others lies within each and every one of us. In Divine Guidance, How to Have a Dialogue with God and Your Guardian Angels, Dr. Doreen Virtue demonstrates how anyone can open the lines of communication with the divine and find the answers to their most intimate concerns. Dr. Virtue shows that we are all equally gifted in our ability and potential to communicate with God, the angels, and the Ascended Masters. Call 1-888-947-3669 to order your copy of Divine Guidance for $21.95. That number is 1-888-WISDOM-9.
Welcome back once again to Virtual You. I'm your host, Jeffrey Mishlove. My guest, Professor Roger France, is author of Essential Spirituality. As I was mentioning at the end of our last segment, your book has a foreword by the Dalai Lama, and it seems to me that he exemplifies in his life some of the principles that you're elucidating in your book. For example, here is a man who lost his country, and you would think that if anyone was entitled to feel bitter, to feel angry, to feel resentful, to feel outraged about what has happened to Tibet, he would, and nobody would fault him for expressing those emotions.
Yes, he's really a remarkable human being. It's amazing to see the impact he's having on the world as a whole. I think he's just amazing, and he's actually one of my heroes. He and Mother Teresa are two of my greatest heroes, and I really count myself extraordinarily fortunate to have spent time with both. And the brief periods I've spent with them just continue to inspire me years later. And the Dalai Lama certainly seems to be embodiment of the qualities which so many of us are trying to cultivate: wisdom, compassion, gentleness, awareness. And he really is an example of what spiritual practices can do. Of course, he worked very hard at them for some 30 or 40 years. He certainly put in his time. But I have to say, I've never been in the presence of someone who was so continuously warm and light and humorous as the Dalai Lama is, and also very smart. I was at a little invitational meeting where he and the chairman of philosophy at Harvard University had a debate, and I'd say I'd have to call it a draw. So he's no dummy either, and clearly he does embody the qualities that the great religions say we can cultivate. They say we can cultivate qualities such as wisdom and love and generosity and compassion. And that, of course, is quite a statement, because we tend so often to think of these qualities such as love or wisdom as being things we're either born with or not. And I think one of the great messages from the great religious and contemplative traditions, as borne out, for example, by someone like the Dalai Lama, is that these qualities are actually skills that are available to all of us. They're skills that each of us can learn and cultivate. And do you think how different our culture would be if we really got that, for example, just to take one quality, love, you know, if we got that that was something that we could learn and train and it was a skill that we could learn?
My sense is, and I may be wrong about this, that if you were to find an average person on Main Street in downtown Peoria and ask them, they would probably tell you that they are kind and loving people and that they have good loving relationships and that there's a lot of self-deception in that. People tend to have a self-image that is often stands in contradiction to their behavior.
Yeah, to some extent, I think we all suffer from that. And you know, contemporary psychology would bear us out that all of us are a mix of qualities. And yes, most people, everyone does want to both experience and express love. And, you know, all of us do a more or less good job at it. But our culture has some very weird ideas about it. You know, love is thought of as something that you can experience if you're in the company of the right person who's the right size and shape and looks the right way and says the right things to you. And then you can feel love. But otherwise, forget it. You know, you're out of luck. And love is this experience which is thought of as something which kind of descends on us, something like an attack of epilepsy. And you know, then it leaves us bereft. But the great religious traditions teach us that love is a quality that we can learn how to cultivate and strengthen and deepen within ourselves, and that it's actually a lifelong art, and that we can practice love. We can learn to love not only more fully and deeply and continuously, but actually even to the point of tasting what has traditionally been thought of as divine love, and to the point that, as the Christian scriptures say, you know, God is love, and we can get a taste of that for ourselves, it said. So the idea is that there are greater depths of love that are possible for all of us, and that we can train and develop those through a variety of skills, or as you call them, Jeff, a kind of inner technology.
Mm-hmm. And for some people, it does seem to come naturally. I'm thinking of the great American humorist, Will Rogers, who said, "I never met a man I didn't like."
Yeah, well, most of us aren't there. It's a one, but that's a wonderful thing to be able to say.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us, I think, have to work at it some and learn how to practice, for example, forgiveness, which is one of the key tools for love. And of course, it's the tool at the heart of the Christian tradition. In fact, one might say that Christianity, more than any of the other great religions, has emphasized the power and centrality of forgiveness as a central spiritual tool, and one which is essential for learning how to love better. Of course, there are other practices, and in general, the great traditions emphasize two kinds of emotional trainings. One is they emphasize letting go unskillful emotions such as fear and jealousy and anger. The other is cultivating positive emotions such as love and joy and compassion. And they offer a variety of techniques and practices, some of them rather complex meditations, some of them very simple techniques. For example, one very simple technique that's emphasized in a couple of traditions, Judaism, Taoism, and Christianity, and was a favorite of the Desert Fathers, the early Christian contemplatives around the 4th and 5th century, is that if you're angry with someone, give them a gift. It sounds very paradoxical. Why would you give a gift to someone you're angry with? But, of course, what these people point out is that it's very hard to feel angry with someone when you give them a gift, and it's also very hard for them to feel angry with you.
Mm. That's very nice. A gift. The very idea of a gift. Well, it happens to be part of the title of your book with Francis Vaughan.
Oh, Gifts from A Course in Miracles, yes.
Isn't there another one, too, called Accept This Gift?
There was a book, Accept This Gift, which is now part of the larger book, Gifts from A Course in Miracles. And, of course, the idea was that the Course in Miracles A Course in Miracles is titled, is a Christian contemplative tradition, which is very powerful and has become quite popular in recent years. And that book was an excerpt of some of its more poetic sayings. So in some ways it felt like a gift to be able to offer this to people. And we felt grateful to have that opportunity.
Well, in religious traditions, we have words like that, a gift, or sometimes a blessing for example. You know, make your life a blessing, as I recall, is a phrase from the Hebrew Bible.
Well, that's a very nice phrase. I don't recall that, but that's beautiful, the idea that we can orient our lives around blessing other people, being a benefit to other people. That's the essence of the central practice of service, which is one of the mm-hmm. seven practices outlined in Essential Spirituality. And it's a practice which lies at the heart of each of the great religious traditions. Interesting enough, service is seen as both a means to awakening and an expression of it. That is, it's said that we can serve and help and bless others as a part of our practice for awakening, and that to whatever extent we practice generosity and service and kindness to other people, to that extent we're cultivating qualities such as generosity, calm, kindness within ourselves, non-grasping, non-attachment, example. And also, as people awaken, then, you know, for example, with the great saints and sages, once they've done their own work, once they have awoken, once they've experienced satori or salvation or moksha, then what's left for them is simply to offer and share that to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And one finds in numerous traditions the idea of the so-called cycle withdrawal and return. That is, that people who are deeply committed to a spiritual life may, for part of their life, for a period, withdraw from society and just deeply engage in spiritual practice. One thinks of them as the hermit monks of Christianity or the yogis of India. And one, but then they after they've done their inner work, they return to offer what they've learned for the benefit of others, to help and to mm-hmm. heal and to serve others.
Mm-hmm. And as we started on this tact by pointing out the idea of giving a gift to someone who you don't like.
Right. Yes, and we find it's a gift to give a gift.
Yeah, it's wonderful to give a gift to everyone, and it's easy to give gifts to the people you do like.
Right.
When you can begin to offer something of value, something of yourself to people who you don't like, I suppose it's a way of breaking through that wall of separation.
Very much so.
When we don't like people, we tend to think of them as somehow different. They're not like us. We couldn't possibly share the same spirit. I'll be back with Dr. Roger France at 6.5 minutes after the top of the hour. Join us then.
And dance to a common beat.
Freedom.
It's a human music.
One we all can feel.
As members of the human family,
we share a spirit deeper than color.
A humanity larger than borders.
That's why it's hard to stand silent.
As our brothers, our sisters,
and our children all over the world
are tortured, imprisoned,
executed,
or disappeared.
Simply for their identity.
All for peacefully expressing their beliefs.
Every day, we at Amnesty International
speak out
to protect the basic human rights of peaceful people everywhere.
To create a voice for humanity that's heard
all over the world.
To change the sounds of suffering
to the sounds of freedom.
Raise your voice.
Call 1-800-AMNESTY and join Amnesty International.
It's your human right.
1-800-AMNESTY.